From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today's special newscast is dedicated to bringing you a preview of the conventions taking place in Cleveland next week for the Republicans and Philadelphia the following week for the Democrats. We will be covering both on the ground from inside and outside the arenas in each case to discuss the two upcoming events. We spoke with Professor Tony Montero, our regular political commentator, via Skype Friday. Professor Montero, welcome back.
Thank you, Don. How are you today?
I'm doing okay, and I'm looking back over the passing or almost past week at some of the things that have happened. Let's chat about it.
Good. You know, I think the thing that really has struck me is the latest New York Times CBS poll that was reported a couple days on the front page of the New York Times, showing that 67% of the voting population say that Hillary Clinton is untrustworthy, and only about 28% say that she is trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, other polls showing that nationally Clinton and Trump are running even, exactly even, 40% each of the electorate. And in swing states of Florida, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, he's leading or they're tied. And this seems to me to present a real dilemma, an almost existential crisis for the Clinton campaign and for the Democratic Party as it prepares to convene here in Philadelphia in a little over a week. So I think they have some real decisions to make about whether they go with Hillary and what that means, and are they prepared for what would be a very humiliating defeat at the hands of Donald Trump, an insurgent who doesn't have the support of even the Republican Party. So this is some very serious stuff that we're looking at right now.
You know, one real interesting thing that caught my eye, we've been talking about before, is the fact that they're tied at 40% each, which means there's 20% mm-hmm. that are, right. you know, thinking of something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very important. And I think it presents a real opportunity for Jill Stein and the Greens to run a 16-state-focused campaign in all of the swing states. In other words, to run with the big dogs
right.
and not be concerned with whether or not they claim that she is going to throw the election from the Democrats to Trump. I don't think she should be concerned about that at all. Run with the big dogs and let the chips fall where they may. They're 20% of the electorate right now that are looking for an alternative to Democrats and Republicans. And that's very, very good. But I think the huge thing is that over 25% of Democrats are unhappy with Hillary Clinton as their nominee. I think, and I don't want to be too speculative about this, there is still a possibility that she could not be or would not be the nominee of the Democratic Party.
You know, there's all this litigation that's out there. It's mm-hmm. not, obviously, or in any event, very apparently not being conducted by Sanders, but rather by people who got involved in the Democratic primary with Sanders mm-hmm. because of promises that were made publicly by Deborah Schultz-Wasserman and other DNC officials that the process would be fair. And then there's this massive pile of evidence, including the exit polls against the certified vote, that in fact it wasn't fair, it was fixed. Mm-hmm. And there are delegates that are going to be fighting on the floor, and perhaps even a legal challenge at the Credentials Committee level to some of Clinton's delegates, that taking place in the context of this polling data and whatever's going on in the streets in Philadelphia. So it may well be a surprise there. But how do they don't want to give it to Sanders if she is if she has to step aside. How are they going to hand it to, like, I don't know, Biden and Warren or something?
Well, you know, this is very interesting. And as we have talked in the past, you know, the great contradiction is Clinton versus the people, Clinton versus the Democratic Party voters. And that's a metaphor in some ways for the people versus Wall Street. So once again, we're back to Occupy 4 years, 5 years ago, Occupy Wall Street, the 1% versus the rest of us. And in a standoff at the Democratic Party with upwards of 100,000 or more people in the streets of Philadelphia protesting on most of the issues that Clinton is identified with, including war, economic inequality, fracking, and other things, I think that... that anything is possible. Now, if the Wall Streeters, the one percenters, the Clinton backers attempt to impose a Biden Warren on the convention, I think all hell breaks loose. And you'll have in Philadelphia what Trump was predicting would happen in Cleveland if they tried to deny him the nomination after he won the most votes and most delegates. I think you could possibly see that in the streets of Philadelphia. The people are not in a mood to accept the dictates of Wall Street after they have gone out, organized, fundraised, voted, and exercised a democracy and made democracy real from the bottom up. They're not prepared to see, in the name of defeating Trump, a Biden-Warren ticket. So I think we're dealing with deep and deepening contradictions that have now become antagonistic. And unlike 4 years ago or 5 years ago with Occupy Wall Street, when you had very little organization, now you have organized masses demanding that they be heard and that their will be implemented. So I think this is very important.
Yeah, I think on that point, we have to take into consideration the fact that, you know, Occupy Wall Street started with a handful of kids as a structure. And you have the Bernie Sanders campaign structure. People have the email lists. They have some money even. And and they've been working for a year. They're battle seasoned already. You've got Black Lives Movement, and you've got the same, you know, basically the same apparatus behind Trump, who won massively the Republican primary with spending like a tenth of what the next person above him spent.
And you know, it's so interesting that that Trump and Sanders got approximately the same number of votes.
Yeah.
So there are 26 million people, approximately, that voted for a political insurgency.
Right.
And if you take the voting, you know, the grid of those who vote, it's like 110 million people,
right.
You know? So we're talking about roughly one-fourth, and this is just in the primary,
right.
One-fourth of the electorate voted for an insurgency. Now, if you take primary voters, Republican and Democrats put together, if you take the total numbers, we're looking at over 50% of those who voted voted for an insurgency.
Right.
This is not insignificant. And as you know, you and I have talked over and over again over the weeks, the Bernie and Trump movement have more in common than either of them have with the establishment of their political party, their respective political parties. And certainly either movement has with Hillary Clinton and the Wall Streeters.
Yeah. And as you mentioned last time we spoke, this election cycle may have nested within it another recession coming, and that you know, is not going to operate in favor of whoever is perceived as the establishment candidate, whether it's Clinton or Biden or Warren or some combination thereof.
Yeah, definitely. It's very possible. And you know, under those circumstances, and this is the key thing politically for the left, how to unite forces that are operating separately at this time. The big one is uniting the Trump elements, and that is the white working class. And let me just say parenthetically, I reject the notion that the Trump movement is a fascist movement and the majority of people in it are out-and-out racists and skinheads and Ku Klux Klan members. That is not the case. The majority of people in the Trump movement are honest working-class people with issues with respect to class consciousness, race, and so on and so forth. But the Trump movement and the Hillary movement, the Sanders movement, must find ways of coming together. The Black Lives Movement must find ways of uniting with the insurgency within the trade union movement, the dissatisfaction in the Rust Belt, in places like Michigan, in Ohio, in Western Pennsylvania, the rejection of the old trade union leadership, be it the UAW or the leadership of the AFL-CIO itself. Black lives must come together with that, and labor must come together with the Black Lives Movement, and the two political insurgencies must find common ground with Black Lives and with the trade union rank and file upsurge. The environmental movement and all of these must come together. So we're talking about a new coalition, a new movement, a new action agenda, a new paradigm, which has the objective function of undoing the two-party governing system of this country. What we're looking at is a return, I think, Don, going forward, a return to grassroots politics and organization. I think the country will literally increasingly become ungovernable. And in the absence of the government of the neoliberal elites, a new people's power can emerge. And that's what we have to focus upon.
You know, it's very rare that you have an opportunity to see things in the kind of relief we see them now. In particular,
yes.
You know, we theoretically know that the idea of racism has been perpetuated, was created and perpetuated to divide the working class so that one segment could be super victimized, enslaved, and all of the things that happened. Others bought off with petty privilege that ends up eating at their feet. But you never really get to see how the mechanics of that operate. And now that you see the elite under siege, they have to work that by dividing the people behind Sanders and the insurgency there and the insurgency that is the Black Lives Matter movement and the Trump white working class. And you can see in the organizing efforts that are going on or whatever that the Clinton campaign, the Democratic Party, and the elites of both parties – see that as job one. They have to provoke incidents with Trump. They have to portray the voters behind Trump as racists and Neanderthals and all of that. How do you combat that and instead stitch them together so that you can empower this, you know, the working class, in essence? Those are the elements of the working class.
Well, you know, the first thing is you have to have confidence in ordinary working people, that given the opportunity, and especially in a moment like this, that their experiences can help them to draw certain conclusions. You know, that's the first thing. The second thing we have to acknowledge, even within these great movements of insurgency, there is unevenness. Everyone is not on the same page. There are more advanced elements. There are less advanced elements. The other thing is that we cannot substitute subjectivism and subjectivity and even dogmatism for an objective, scientific, even ethnographic understanding and study of what's going on the ground. What's going on the ground, and this is across the world, especially in the advanced capitalist countries, is that the working people, the working class is being immiserated, impoverished, unemployed, social services cut, healthcare cut, and so on. Brexit was a moment, an important moment in a working class rejection of the political elites that brought us neoliberal globalization and the financialization of the world economy. Now, I think that we, out of all of this, must come forward not just with a plan to unite, but with a program that speaks to the basic needs of the working people and the middle class and the young and the imprisoned and the impoverished as a whole, a program that unites. And I would say, first and foremost, we have to talk about a jobs and infrastructure and clean energy, massive trillion, multi-trillion dollar program over a decade. That is the first thing. We have to put America back to work. The second thing, a rejection of all of these neoliberal trade agreements that have impoverished not only workers in the United States, but all over the world, and intends to even intensify that. The third thing is we have to shut down the big banks. We have to call upon the government to take over the big banks, break them up, that the Federal Reserve becomes and the Treasury Department become instruments, if they can. I don't know, maybe they can't be, but if they can, that monetary financial policy become instruments of empowering the people. I heard one economist refer to it as quantitative easing for the people. Yeah. And I would say from that, a number of other issues concerning the police, breaking up these militarized police departments all around the country, criminalizing the criminals on the police force rather than the masses of poor and working class black and brown people. So I think we have to come forward with such a program. Not that we impose it from above upon movements, but we connect it organically to the movements that are out there already.
And of course, we could do that with foreign policy as well. There's your money.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yes, I'm sorry to have omitted that. Yes.
And, you know, looking at the international scene, I think it's interesting, while we're sitting here contemplating what kind of wrecking work basically is going to be done to divide the working class here, I think it's interesting that in France, where first they elected a socialist government in the midst of this crisis, and, you know, replacing Sarkozy with Hollande, and then suddenly And then the people are in the streets in France like nobody's business. That is the most active working class rebellion on the planet right now. There's three major terrorist attacks in the past year, year and a half: Charlie Hebdo, Paris, and now Nice. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm wondering if we're going to be looking at something like that here as, you know, an attempt to make certain that the working class remains divided instead of, you know, trying to unite with a program.
Yeah, I think it's very, very possible. And we have to be ideologically and politically prepared for it. One of the things that's so clear in France is even with these successive terrorist attacks upon ordinary citizens. And you know, that kind of suggests something. You know, why do you punish unarmed, ordinary people? Suggesting something, but those kinds of provocations do not enhance the political standing of unpopular governments with their people. For instance, Hollande, his ratings are, what, about 9%? And they do not go up, even though he gives these so-called anti-terrorist speeches and imposes states of emergency. And even in the state of emergency, millions of French working people and young people are in the streets. You get these colliding tendencies within world history, the West's foreign policy and actual direct on the ground actions lead to the rise of Al-Qaeda, of ISIS, of terrorism, which always attacks ordinary people, does not attack or regimes or governments that are not in line with the West or NATO, never attacks the centers of power. So it's obviously a form of terrorism that comes from the right and not from the people. I think that we have to look at these things very carefully. We have to be prepared for it here. You know, there are going to be thousands of people marching in Cleveland and in Philadelphia. The ground is very fertile for all kinds of provocation because the movements are not yet ideologically or organizationally set up to handle such provocation. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So we have to be prepared for that, I would say.
And finally, going into Cleveland this coming Monday, as the media attempts to caricature the white working class that is there to support Trump as ignorant, racist, bigoted, and basically something to be feared, fascists. How do you counter that effort by, you know, showing the actual character of it to people? And how do you get people who have been stirred up because of a justifiable reaction to the history of things that, look, these are the people that you need to work with, or else you're going to lose.
Well, you know, I prefer a Bernie Sanders over both Clinton and Trump. I prefer Jill Stein over all of them.
Right.
But the real deal is that we're dealing with a proven threat to humanity and a brinksmanship politician in Hillary Clinton. There is no question about it. On international policy, Trump runs to the left of Clinton. Now, that doesn't make him the answer to the problems of war and peace. But he somehow is calling for what is a detente, a pullback from brinksmanship and aggression. Therefore, this equation or mantra that Clinton is the neoliberal and Trump is the neo-fascist does not fit the objective conditions. It might, you know, fulfill certain subjective, emotional needs to make sense of a world in transition, but that's not the reality. On trade and trade deals and neoliberal globalization, Trump is to the left of Clinton. On race, Hillary Clinton shares one thing, but has been associated with the most violent structural racism that we can imagine. However, Trump does not give us or the working class the type of discourse which diffuses and helps to lead white working and middle class people out of their morass of white supremacy and anti-black racism. Now, so therefore, I think that the target of our ideological and political efforts going forward must be Hillary Clinton, and they must be anti-Hillary Clinton. And then, and that means up to the convention, I think this is an important moment. These next 2 weeks here in Philadelphia are going to be very, very important because, again, it is not an absolute certainty that Clinton will be the nominee. She might withdraw on her own or under pressure, but Clinton must be the target. At the same time, we cannot be unmindful of the rise of a fascist, skinhead, Nazi forces who do not have a mass base and can only rely upon provocation and embedding themselves in the white working class and attempting to appear to be the spokespersons of the interests of the white working class. I think that that the answer, again, is that we must go deep into the working class. We must come forward with a program of unity, both in domestic policy and jobs creation and infrastructure and clean energy building, a type of 21st century W Works Project Administration, a 21st century New Deal. People say the government is in so much debt. How do you finance that? Well, you take the money from where it's at. It's in the bank. You know, and just like you have quantitative easing for the 1%, well, let's think about quantitative easing for the majority of us. I think there's a way ahead, but we have to have the courage and the ideological clarity to go forward and not to be paralyzed by the, the provocation of the media. And we cannot accept stereotypes of either black people, Latino people, or white working people. We have to have objective evidence. And I think we only get that by being with working people, being in conversation with working people, and helping to solve the political, ideological, and organizational issues confronting the working people at this time.
Professor Montero, thank you very much. It's going to be very interesting in Cleveland next week and Philadelphia the week after.
Indeed.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening, and we'll be speaking with you from Cleveland next week.